Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon, alongside St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Barden Co-Recruitment in partnership with District 4. This podcast will explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century.
If you've got a good starting point, you're going to work your way back to that. You know, whereas if you grow up without feeling loved and valued, and then you meet someone that just exasperates that, then it's where does a young person go from there?
It's now time. This is the Community Safety Podcast. Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. My name is Jim Nixon, and I've been involved in community safety for over 28 years. This podcast will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. Today's guest is Michelle Bougie. She's a sports development coordinator working in Glasgow. Her role is to support the development of young people, providing as many opportunities as possible. Michelle is also an author and recently produced and published a book called A Heart Full of Love. Michelle, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, Jim.
When I was growing up in the 70s and 80s in the West Midlands, a couple of areas that I always was, number one, intrigued about, but also possibly a little bit sort of wary and a little bit scared of, was number one was Belfast, for obvious reasons, and number two was Glasgow. And actually, when I did go to Glasgow finally a few years back, I was really, really impressed. Tell me what it was like for you as a young person growing up in Glasgow.
Jim, it was, you know, and I stayed in Glasgow. I grew up in Drumchapel, which is classed as one of the kind of really highly socially deprived areas. But, you know, I was there for 34 years and I had a great childhood there. I think for me, probably the biggest anchor was sport. You know, we had a lot of kind of youth activities and opportunities through the youth club, and I spent quite a bit of time there. But I had really kind of solid friendships and peer groups. But I also was fortunate enough that I went to school out with, so I almost had, different views from Glasgow. So my school was in the West End. I grew up in Drumchapel. So I had quite a wide lens, and then my football sort of took me in different places. So I think for me, you know, as I said, even in what would be described as an area people may avoid, I had a really nice experience, and I'm never leaving here. There's just coffee shops and restaurants and parks and museums all on my doorstep.
Yeah, Drumchapel's got, isn't that famous for like the football club there, is that right? There's a lot of professional footballers that have come through that. David Moyes, I think, is linked to it, and a lot of others, is that right?
Yeah, they've got a great, certainly over the last, well, it's probably not just been the last few years, but it's really kind of came into the spotlight in the last few years. Drumchapel United and I think it's Drumchapel, there's like two teams in Drumchapel, but they've got a whole big, they've took over one of the sports clubs there, and they've got a great framework for young people coming through, and they've got a girls academy as well. So there's lots of incredible work in Drumchapel, Jim. Lots of people that have been volunteering for 30 years plus, running table tennis clubs, gymnastics clubs, boxing clubs, football. So it's a really strong sense of community spirit there.
When you were sort of growing up as a kid, you were quite lucky that you were sort of like me. I was very much attracted to sport, and I actually think that that's kept me out of trouble. But what was the actual area like? What was, you know, was it quite a crime rhythm area? How would you describe it?
What I would say is for growing up, it becomes your sort of a circle of influence. You know, what's acceptable? People taking drugs, you know, underage alcohol, you know, violence wasn't, you know, it was almost a given that you were exposed to that. So I suppose in that way, it's, I think from my mindset, I'm always a kind of glass half full. So I'm always looking at the kind of silver linings. But the reality is the cards can be stacked against you, and you've got to kind of outplay them, really.
Yeah. Because it felt like back then, you know, certainly when I was growing up, and I presume it was a bit when you were growing up, it kind of felt that Glasgow, the kind of the heroin capital of the country, and everybody seemed to focus on that. You know, I remember growing up, you know, thinking, oh, I wouldn't want to go there. You know, it's full of druggies and and that kind of place. Was it kind of like that when you were growing up?
Not so much heroin, Jim. I didn't really know much about heroin at that time, but what I do know is, you know, behind every person I've known grown up that's turned to addiction, there's been incredible pain behind the addiction, you know. So I knew them as young people, and I know what their pain was, I know what their struggle was, and then I've met them in adult years, and it's just heartbreaking because I know behind that addiction there was a real struggle, and I knew them when they were children, and I knew that wasn't meant to be their path. Life kind of takes over for them.
You see the horrible things that it does to individuals, and as an ex-police officer, I've seen that myself, you know, and the terrible decline of an individual over a period of time. The people that you knew, can you understand the reasons why? Do you think they were attracted to that kind of lifestyle?
I don't think they were attracted to it. I think their initial attraction was fitting in,
yeah.
You know, belonging to something.
Yeah.
And then the second to that was, you know, self-medicating, numbing out the pain, not having the right support. Even people that did have a strong parental support, they still didn't kind of stop the need to fit in, or, you know, they were being bullied outside, or for other people it was just so they then don't become the bullied, you know, they take drugs and then they become, it gives them a bravado that they didn't have. And again, it's a generalization for women and the females I knew, there was a desire to be loved that they just couldn't find anywhere else, and for the male it was a desire to fit in and to be somebody. Or but I think for me, when I think back and I see young people today, if I could reach every young person in school, it'd be no matter what your challenges, do not turn to drugs, because it just then exposes them to a whole other misery. No one sets out to become a heroin addict, you know.
No chance. For me, it's not just the life of that individual, having again seen this. It's the knock-on effect, isn't it, that it has, yeah. And the impact it has on the wider family and friends as well, you know, the stealing, you know, the constant kind of demands that come with that kind of lifestyle. So it affects a whole community at the end of the day,
yeah.
Not just that individual that's addicted to the drug.
100%, Jim. And I think they've got the pain, and then they've got the addiction, and then they've got the shame, and the shame just manifests. You know, every time I've seen people trying to go into recovery, but every time they go into recovery, they have to face, you know, the things that the shame of the things they've done, and then rather than face that, they, you know, it's just, they just want to numb it again, you know, and it just becomes such a vicious cycle. But like you say, for everyone else on the standing on the sidelines of that.
One of the things I picked up on what you said earlier as well is that even though these kind of things are going on, taking Drumchapel as an example, the community spirit to me sounded really, really positive. And what I've seen with a lot of deprived areas, there is some real good community cohesion, and people do look out for each other and they, yeah, stick together. Is that something that you experienced from your childhood and as you were growing up in that area?
Yeah, 100%, Jim. And also people, you know, when people do well, everyone celebrates that. You know, someone achieves something out with what anyone expected, and it's huge celebration. And also I've seen people, you know, really rock bottom, see when they find their way back up, they're just invited back into the party. You know, there's no like, oh, you can't come now because you've done it. It's very much like, right, you're trying, come back in. You know, that's what I've seen, and that's such a really, really, and people just wanting to help other people as well. You know, like I've known people in the depths of despair that would still advise someone else, don't go down that road, don't take that, don't, you know, when the easy thing in that stage is to be just to drag everyone down with them. But in my case, I've seen many people like, you don't want to go down that road, look at me, you know, that kind of thing.
That's for, yeah, me, what community should be about, not just pointing, yeah, the finger. I've used this terminology before, not writing people off. We need to write people in. Everybody, yeah, makes mistakes.
100%.
Without delving into any specific details, I just wanted to really ask you about sort of resilience, really, and the strength that you may have found during difficult times when you were sort of, you know, a young adult, how you've overcome those sort of difficult challenges, you know, the mechanisms that you may have put in place.
I've thought about that so many times, and I always think, why is it? How did that, you know, what did that do? Because I know from way back there was just this desire inside, and it wasn't about because, you know, I know we're talking about resilience and not ambition. I've never had a high ambition to, but I just had a resilience that I wasn't going to be, you know, or I couldn't let myself fail, you know. It was never about, and I think for me, I was always just reading, learning, listening, you know. In the most recent, well, in the last 10 years when I discovered TED Talks, they were huge. Like, you know, anything I can find that improves your life, you know, I'm all in, you know. And I think, again, going back to sport and connection, I think they've always been a huge part. And just as I said, I just had two girls. I was 19 when I had my first daughter, 21 when I had my second. So I had every reason to, you know, to find a way forward. And I just searched and dug in. And now I have a list, I have a go-to, like, what I know for sure works in the hardest moments, because I think it's so easy to close off and shut down, you know, as a self-protection. But if, when during the hardest times, when you need to stay open and tap into all the things, you know, I feel there's an inner resilience, but I can't figure out if the inner resilience comes from everything I've learned, or I've learned it because I had the desire for resilience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get what you mean. Growing up, obviously, in Scotland, you know, a hard-hitting area, Glasgow, as a very young mum, how did you find that when you were actually sort of, you know, in that situation? It must have been quite a tough situation for you at that time.
It was, Jim, because you're on the back foot, you know, but you're, you know, you've got two, as I said, I had two girls, and I went back to college when my youngest daughter was one, so I was 22 when I went back, and that was probably one of the best decisions. I had no idea what I was going to do. I just knew I needed to do something. Well, it was sport. I did sports coaching, but I didn't have a big end goal or a big plan for the end when I, you know, so I went to college and then I went to uni, and that was definitely the best decision I ever made, because I knew I had to financially provide,
sure.
You know, I had to have a secure job, which I did. When I finished uni, I got a job working in the children's units with, looked after and accommodated young people. And that was brought in a great income and gave us great opportunities. But you don't, when you start life as a young mum, you don't get to choose where you live, what school your kids go to, you know. So you're swimming against the tide, but, you know, you've got two lives that you're trying so hard. So I would just be going to every art gallery, museum, every activity, where we're out playing sport, we're going swimming, anything to expose their young mind. The smallest details, the, you know, the nicest quilt, the warm bed, not that I never had those things, but I'm just so grateful for, and I don't think I'll ever stop being grateful. And I suppose that's one of the greatest gifts of my life experience, is that now it's like every day I'm just so grateful.
You seem to me to one of these people that the glass is very much half full rather than half empty. And I think you see the positives in a lot of life, you know, and you're very grateful for everything that you've got. And I think sometimes people don't realise just when they're well off. And it's just brilliant to see, you know, your attitude. Who were your role models that have inspired you?
My mum, for one. You know, my mum was one of nine. So when I was born, I had four aunties and on my mum's side. And I had two on my dad's side. I had both grandparents. And I think all of that has made, I think the love has been not so much what any one person has done, although I've had lots of people that have done different things. But I think the biggest driver was when I had my girls and I thought, I need to be for them, you know. And I always tell the story that they could never so much as set me free or be my role models, because I had to be that for them. But when my daughter had my granddaughter, then she sort of set me free, because it was a different love and a different energy at a different time in life, you know.
I think being a grandparent, I was very much like you, a young parent. I think it's a complete different level of love, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know. I think you just described that really, really well there. But having, you know, I've got two granddaughters, and you know, I think it's really important that, you know, you give them that support and that love. you know, on on a really regular basis, you know, and let them know that they're completely loved. And the reason I'm kind of saying this again is that, you know, this podcast is all about community and it's all about safer communities and how we can be better people so that our communities are safe. And I think this kind of parenting approach is the way forward to help make those communities safer. If people feel loved and they feel supported, like you did, then individuals go on to do great things in life, and that's got to be great for communities.
And it gives you something to go back to. You know, as I said, life will, like love, I think, is the one thing that can really set people off on a different path. But if you've got a good starting point, you're going to work your way back to that. You know, whereas if you grow up without feeling loved and valued, and then you meet someone that just exasperates that, then it's where does that road go then? You know, where does a young person go from there?
It's about those family foundations. If you've got that early support and something goes wrong, you've always got that to come back to, haven't you? That strong family. But if you're kind of out on a limb and you then hit rock bottom and you haven't got that support, Where does that leave you? Leaves you completely out in the cold, doesn't it? And I think the problem with that then is that you just go from one bad relationship to another, potentially. Spiralling effect. You're listening to the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon. Today we're talking sports development and development of communities with Michelle Bowgie. Transitioning to sports development, you've said already that you really enjoyed sport when you were growing up. How did you kind of get into that? And sort of take that on as a career?
I have no idea, Jim. My love of football is a passion I just had since I was young. And obviously back then, early 80s, there was no opportunity really for female. You know, I just had to play alongside all the boys, and that's what, you know, that's how I played until I was about 15, and then I played for a girls' team after we had that, like a big festival, and then this one of the managers of the women's team had asked me to go play for them. So football was just, that was my passion. As with just being active, I was always really, really active. And I think, to be honest, Jim, at school, you know, it's amazing how now I have such a hunger for learning and I have such a curious mind. But at school, I didn't really feel that. And I don't know if it was just the age I was at or... You know, I never caused any bother, but it just felt like everyone knew something that I didn't really know, you know, but I just went under the radar. So when I left school, I thought, I've no idea what I'm going to do. The only thing I know I can do is sport. And then I went back to study that when I was 22. It was HMD in sports coaching with development. And I loved it, but I'm more than the sport, I love the psychology side as well, which again is always a personal interest. So it just shows you. So I think that's how I didn't know where the HMD, I didn't want to do a degree, I didn't know where it was going to take me. I just knew I needed to do something, and I needed to have a sense of achievement. You know, I had to know that I'd achieved something. And then a job came up for coaching. I went into coaching, and then a job came up in the development office, and I got the job. And even though I studied development, I had no idea about development. But 14 years later, I think I've found my feet. I kind of know. So I understand it now. But when I first started, I was thinking, you know, my manager kept saying, you just, in the interview, you spoke like a coach. And I was like, because that's all I know. All I've been is a coach. I don't know how to develop programs. And I've been there ever since.
I think sport was my saviour. I think I could have easily have gone one way or the other, and it was quite ironic that I ended up being a police officer. But from your perspective, how important do you think those kind of activities are to divert young people away from going down that route?
Oh, I think they're so important, Jim. Like the one of the most important things, and like you say, I don't just mean sport. It was for me, it was sport, but I think writing, creative writing, you know, like painting, anything at all that just gives young people somewhere to go, you know, somewhere to go, a place to be, and somewhere where they can belong, you know, whatever that is for them. Like, we know that in fact, we know it's a big challenge for young people that don't like sport, because there's a huge focus on it, and you're only going to do it if you can play. Sure. You know, you're not going to go and join in if you're not any good, you know. So, yeah, I think they are crucial. I think they need to bring back, I don't know about what it's like down your way, Jim, but here we, you know, they sort of did away a lot with the youth clubs and community development. We're slowly bringing it back in, but the value of community development officers who've studied this field, who know how to engage with young people, who've studied all the implications around young people and offending behaviours and how to intervene, and then I think we need to get people right in the heart of the community doing, but not just in deprived areas, because I know, as I said, when I look at Drumchapel, they've got a great, but in other areas as well, because just, you know, everyone needs a sense of belonging, you know. So yeah, I think they're hugely important for growth, not just as a prevention for crime, but for growth and for socialisation and a sense of community.
I owe a lot to sport, I'll be honest with you. If I hadn't have, and you're right, you know, I was good at athletics, so, you know, you kind of naturally gravitate to something that you're good at. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to sort of, you know, get it across that, you know, it isn't just sport, you know, it's like you said, it's about finding what you enjoy and what you're good at. You know, that sense of belonging, it's so much better to have that positive sense of belonging within a sports club or whatever it is you choose to do. Because for me, the alternative is going down that wrong route. That's why I think, you know, it's so important that, you know, governments get this right. Youth clubs and youth provision has been decimated across England, Scotland and Wales. And we've really got to see it coming back, because it's just, it plays such a vital role in getting young people on track.
I think as well, like, alongside the sense of belonging, the friendships that are formed, you know, some, you know, girls maybe meet each other at seven at dancing and they're friends right through. And a Friday night, they're getting ready for dancing on a Saturday. Where does the girls go that don't go to dancing, that don't? And that's where the community clubs come in. You know, it's almost a blessing if you're musical or sporty, or but where, what about all the young people that don't have a significant, you know, or an obvious talent? You know, I believe everyone has a talent, but I mean, just the less obvious ones, where do they go?
Absolutely. It's definitely something that, you know, I'm hoping we see more and more of this, you know, re-emergence of good quality, you know, young people provision. It's a must, you know, and it's that knock-on effect that if we don't get it right, then it costs everybody more money and time and ruins lives, because kids aren't getting the right kind of engagement. So I think we're both on the same page. I want to ask you about community engagement. What strategies kind of do you employ to sort of engage young people, particularly in those kind of deprived areas? How are you, you know, getting these young people on board and getting them to kind of stick at, you know, these kind of activities?
So we do, because I'm part of the wider team, so my remit within Glasgow Life is the health walks, and mostly the health walks are actually 50 plus or older adults. Okay. I'm also an SQA assessor for, so we have like a young sports coaching program.
Got it.
It's called Coach Court, and that looks at young people that maybe have dropped out of school or not got an obvious destination, and then they can do an apprenticeship for the year and train up. So, and again, I think it's just about being person-centred, you know, listening to the young people, what they want, what their fears are, not placing them in sessions that don't work for them. It's just, yeah, finding what their passion is and trying to nurture that rather than shoehorn them into, you know, activities that don't meet their needs, because that's when you do get a drop-off. And the team that, you know, that manage that whole program, they're excellent. You know, they have a really, really strong bond with the young people and a really strong support there for them.
Yeah, it's so important, you know, so vitally important to, you know, have the right people leading these young people, keeping them on track, you know. It's so, so important. Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I want to ask you about life lessons. What lessons have you carried on with from your upbringing that, you know, you kind of bring into your current endeavours? What sort of lessons have you learned?
I think probably finding, as I said, I was from a really kind of, you know, working class, like, family, and everyone just taking the joy in the simple moments is definitely one. You know, there's no harm in striving for more. You know, no shame in wanting more and wanting bigger and better, and, you know, but there's also no shame in every day looking at what you've got and been truly grateful for that. I think they, again, being active, you know, like no matter what, just, and I'm very much for the girls, you know, like they have a love for, like, not so much the gym, but staying active and healthy. Because I've seen them on their kind of off days going, right, I know what I need to do. I need to get out and get fresh air and, you know, stay active. So I'd say them, gym, and I think the lesson I sort of pass on to them as well, treat love like it's the biggest decision you'll ever make. Because I think for, in a work capacity, you know, we've put so much pressure on young people around, you know, career, you know, what you're going to do next, what's after school, what's after college, what's after uni. The worst case scenario, there's always another job, there's always another career, there's always another road to walk. But choosing love or accepting the wrong love at a young age, I think has huge implications for young people, both male and female. Or at any age, actually, not just young, at any age.
There was something that you wrote that you sent to me, and it had that quote within that path, one of the passages. And I just thought, that's amazing. That is such great advice. Because if I'm being honest with you, people will put more effort into buying a car than they will to choose a partner. And and I think that is the biggest decision you'll ever make in your life. And if it doesn't feel right, then you walk away. I'd be keen on your views, but you know, I saw an awful lot of domestic abuse in the police. A lot of people that had made that wrong choice. We're living a life of misery, and that's not the choices that we want for our own children.
Definitely not, Jim. And as I said, like when I say that, and I know the young people will fall in love and fall out of love, and as long as there's no mass destruction, that's life. You know, people, you might love someone, doesn't love you back, someone might love you, you don't love them back, or you're on a different path. That's all okay. It's when it's cruel love, you know, that's a love that no one should ever have to accept or be exposed to or have to endure. And I think that has huge implications. Again, I think like addiction, it just runs through the threads in families, and it's a very, very like poverty, addiction, domestic violence. And I think you can only break the cycles when you stand against. But I think for young people, it's a lesson they don't need to learn. You know, life will throw curveballs, but recovering from a violent relationship or a toxic relationship is not a lesson they need to learn. They'll grow on their own time. You know, no one needs to be forced these lessons, I don't think.
That's what I was just thinking. You know, young people sometimes aren't the best at listening to us adults that have got a bit of experience. And I was just going to ask you the question, how do we give that advice without becoming, you know, too overbearing?
You're right, Jim. You've got to, especially with your own kids, you know, you've got to let them walk their own path. You know, we know from tales old as time, people only learn when they've experienced it, no matter how many times you can say. So in a sense, you've got to let people, you can guide them, you know, and offer advice, and certainly hold back in the judgment, because judgment doesn't change anything. But I think like we've got like kind of, as I said, I don't know about England or Wales, Jim, but in Glasgow, you've got the violence reduction unit. So you've got people with lived experience going into schools, talking to young males about violence, knife crime. We need women in talking to girls about relationships. We also need both male and female around healthy relationships, whether that's heterosexual, same-sex. You know, we need to get people in with lived experience and really homing in on the relationship side of life, you know, especially with social media and lots of things getting screenshotted and shared. And, you know, it's a minefield now. Well, I guess it's no different. It just looks a bit different because we've got mobile phones now. But I think the only way to do it is in kind of, is getting people in. I see a lot of people in LinkedIn. You know, one of the gentlemen I'm connected with is out today speaking to a school, you know, about addiction. And that's what we need for kind of almost every avenue of life, I think.
I think it comes back to what you said earlier around, I'm a big believer in that early intervention. For me, there's a reason why somebody becomes an offender, you know, whether that be, you know, an offender of, you know, robbery, or whether they become a domestic abuse offender. There's got to be a reason why they go down that path. And for me, some of that has to look, you have to look back and track back at their early life. And when I hear you talking about love, support, encouragement as a young girl into, you know, your adulthood, I do feel that sometimes that aspect, when we examine when people go the wrong way, something has clearly gone wrong in their earlier part of life.
Well, yeah, 100%, Jim. And I've seen, you know, the bullied become the bully, and that be that, you know, male on male or male on female, you know, and that there's a desperation around. And again, I don't want to generalise, but in my experience, there's a desperation. There's this desperation for love that's seeking it in all the wrong ways, that pushes people away. The desperation gets higher, you know, and it ends in violence, you know. But there's, like you said, like for everyone, there's a whole other story that, you know, you may or may not know, but there's, and it doesn't make an excuse, no. Like, but there's usually a reason, you know. And I can say, you know, I can say that I'm not excusing terrible behaviour for anyone, but people that are loved and valued and supported don't then go on to harm other people.
I spoke to a nursery nurse, and when I was in the police, and I said to her, you know, would you be able to kind of pick out from your day-to-day interaction with some of these kids, you know, who will be, you know, go on to, you know, cause concerns, you know? And she was saying to me, yeah, without a doubt. And that got me thinking around of this early intervention, you know, that we really do need to sort of get into kids and find out. And I appreciate all the family complexities with that.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is some value in that early intervention that will then prevent some individuals going on to offend later on. And again, like you said earlier, if you work on the success rate of one, you can't go far wrong, really, because that affects so many different lives.
Jim, I think as well, a lot of it's looking at self-fulfilling prophecy as well. You know, like, I see so many reports around, you know, you're likely to, you know, you're more at risk of suicide, or, you know, if you've got a parent in prison, and I know those facts are, I know they're true, they're not coming from nowhere, but I also think we need to do all we can to support every child that's experiencing adversity, 100% all day long. But I think we also need to share stories of hope and not keep feeding this is the reported outcomes for people that, you know, live with a parent with addiction, live with a parent in prison. You know, I think we need to feed stories of hope and give them another frame of reference and not just what the worst outcomes could possibly be.
Which moves really nicely onto my next question in terms of developing communities, making communities safer. And I do appreciate that there are lots of different definitions of community. But on a whole, how do you think that in the 21st century that we can make communities stronger and safer?
I think it goes back to what I said earlier, Jim. I think it's getting community development officers, getting the youth clubs that have been demolished, rebuilt, getting qualified community development workers, local youth leaders in the clubs, you know, because albeit the community development officers, you know, we had an amazing community development officer in Drumchapel, and then he had local youth leaders who were a familiar face for people, you know, because he's coming in trying to create change, and he doesn't know people and have a relationship that can be hard, but he used, you know, the skills of everyone there, you know, to create that change and bring about positive action. You know, I think we went from having maybe 10 in the youth club to 100 people.
Wow.
You know, just, you know, he had a very, very strong sense of belonging and knew exactly how to reach young people. And I think we need each person doing their little bit within their family. You know, like the old, I think it's a Buddhist quote that says, you want to change the world, go and wash the dishes for your mum. You know, we need the smallest steps within family homes, and we need the experts in the communities, you know, community facilities that are open, you know, lunch clubs and, you know, after school clubs, and because, you know what, see, no matter what a child's life is like at home, and if there's nothing anyone can do about that, at least give them somewhere to go for a few hours a day where they're safe.
When we're trying to build those specific communities, they tend to parachute people in that don't understand those communities. And I think it's really important that, say, a community's got a pot of money and they want to develop, we really need to speak to those people in that community. Even if somebody comes in to help them, they must listen to those community members who, you know, you and your community, when you live there, would know that area so much better than it, professionals coming in. It's got to start within those communities, hasn't it?
I think so, Jim. And I just think if everyone just makes one conscious step forward, just look to the places that are doing really well and, you know, just learn from them.
Big believer in that. Don't reinvent the wheel. Every area's got their own uniqueness. But I do think I am a big believer that, you know, if it's worked somewhere, then there's a good chance if you modify it, it can work there too. I think that's great advice, Michelle. I wanted to talk about your book before I let you go. I know you don't class yourself as an author, but I certainly do. Tell me about your book.
Yeah, so it was out on the 8th of December. And speaking of family and influence and role models, unbeknownst to me, my daughters and my mum and my partners organised a surprise book gathering launch party. So I went into what I thought I was going to a kid's party at the bowling club, and there was like 100 people in the room.
Wow.
So I thought, like, I feel like everybody I've ever known in my life was in this one room, and I had no idea. So that was a big celebration, and that was lovely. And, you know, Jim, that all I could think was, no one in this room cares less whether I sell one book or 10 books. Like, no one cares. They just care that you've created something, you know, what I thought possible, what they thought possible.
Yeah, it's like this podcast, you know. It's, for me, the way I look at this podcast is, you know, my grandkids can probably listen to this in 100 years' time or whatever, my great-great-great grandkids. It's leaving a mark, isn't it? For me, it doesn't matter how many people listen to this podcast, you know. If it helps one or two people, but I get immense pleasure out of doing it, and I suspect that's the same with you in your book.
The thing is, Jim, I never set out to write a book. I just had words during lockdown. You know, everything just stopped, and I had been on the, I go to work, it became quite, that's what I do, I go to work, everything's okay as long as I'm at work. And then it was like, well, you can't come into work, you have to work from home. And I was thinking, what am I going to do? Like, I go to work, I had a little bit of a panic, I suppose. And then, I had a routine for myself, and I just started writing. I don't know where it came from. I can never remember at the moment I decided I'm going to write. I just had these words, and I just typed and typed and typed. I've now got about 80 stories, like blogs, that are just for me. And I've got the book, and I've got about another 27,000 words on, you know, it's just the kind of the whole story. And it was inspired by my granddaughter, who was 6 at the time. And it was just about harnessing self-love. And again, everything we've spoke about, you know, it all comes back to that for me. And then I had to go and start researching what a manuscript looked like, and that I had to research everything because I knew nothing, absolutely nothing about publishing.
So the book is basically about sort of around your granddaughter and sort of self-love. Is that effectively what it's about?
Yeah, it's about harnessing self-love. So she's a superhero and she's not allowed to save people. She's to show them how to save herself. Because I didn't want, you know, kind of white Scottish girl saving the world. So she goes around the globe, you know, sharing this message. She shares it with one person, they share it with someone else, and it's a kind of like the ripple effect. And it touches on kind of some, without going too deep, because I would never want to assume that I know how it feels for a young boy living in Syria, but just trying to imagine, you know, how it might feel. So it's just touching on just a little bit on kind of sensitive subjects, or how a young girl might feel if she doesn't have the right swimming clothes, you know, and how he almost say, like, I see you, like, you know, who you are inside matters more than any of this sort of thing. So it's just about harnessing self-love and sharing that.
And that comes back to what you were saying earlier in the conversation around how you are so grateful for the simple things in life. And I think that's what we take for granted. But like you say, a young child in Syria or a family in Syria, or, you know, in Ethiopia or whether it might be, life is so different, isn't it, compared to what we experience. Yeah.
And I just knew I had, like, I just had this kind of message to share, and I never let anyone see it, not a single soul. And then I kind of thought, right, and then it's going to be live, and I thought, maybe I should have let somebody see it, you know, because I felt so beyond anything I would ever, you know, I felt so above my station, like, and I just couldn't let anyone, I was too shy to let anyone see it, but I don't know what I thought was going to happen when everyone bought the book. I was like, oh, maybe I should have. And I think anticipated the joy for, certainly for Hallie, who's the main character. So she was like, I'm having an internal meltdown at putting myself out there, and she's going, I'm going to be famous, you know. But the joy for my mum, you know, I never, of course, I should have anticipated it because I'm a mum, but she was just, that has been one of the best moments, like, oh, just seeing amazing. How much joy.
It's an amazing story, Michelle, it's amazing. And it's called A Heart Full of Love. And can you get it, I presume, Amazon and all the sort of normal sort of main bookshops, are they stocking it?
Yeah, so Amazon, Waterstones, WH Smith, Barnes & Noble, they're the kind of main ones. Everyone tells me that it's on because my mum's like, oh, do you see it's on such and such?
That is brilliant. And have you got plans for more? You just said you've got a few blogs and that. Are you hopefully going to bring out more books?
I've got a kind of same one pretty much done, but I had to sort of take my foot off the gap because honestly, I think since the 4th of January, I've just been like, boom, because it's been, you know, it's been excitement overload, like, and you know, you just kind of crash. So I was like, right, let's just process this and absorb this and enjoy the moment. So as I said, I've got another one pretty much ready. And again, it will be look at sensitive subjects, you know, around, you know, like what children might feel without going too into detail, or I don't know, you know, like, I don't work in that field. I know I've certainly looked after and accommodated young people, and I did gain a lot of insight from that, but in my own personal life as well.
I love it. Fantastic the way that you've done that. And again, what a great legacy for your granddaughter.
That's the really nice part. It's all of that. It's just honestly, just sometimes even now I'm like, it's so hard to even imagine, like, I don't know, it's so hard to just say, you know, do you know what I mean? It's like you were just in here in the kitchen doing your own thing, and then suddenly I brought a book.
Brilliant. I can't wait for the next one to come out, Michelle.
Thanks so much.
Really, really enjoyed this chat. You are just the kind of person that, you know, I would want in my community.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thanks for having me on, and it's been so nice because, like you know, I've followed your stuff for many years. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. If you liked today's episode, please follow and write a 5-star review and tell us what you liked about the episode, and we'll catch it on the next episode.
Alongside support from St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Barden Co Recruitment, in partnership with District 4, you have been listening to the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.